The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with speaker Peter Arnett.
Today we are commemorating Freedom of Information Day, which, as it happens, is the birthday of James Madison, author of the First Amendment. We are here not only to honor those who have made important contributions to freedom of the press around the world, but also to remind us of why press freedom is so important. The Committee to Protect Journalists today released its annual report, Attacks on the Press in 1994, which documents a record number of reporters who were beaten, imprisoned, and killed last year. Before getting into today's program, I'd like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Lucy Dalglish, Freedom of Information Chairperson for the Society of Professional Journalists. Jane Kirtley, Executive Director, Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Gil Klein, Media General News Service and immediate past president of the National Press Club. John Walcott, an editor at U.S. News and World Report, a former colleague of mine. Sonia Hilgren, Farm Journal and vice president of the National Press Club. Dr. Abdulaziz Al-Sakaf, excuse me, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Yemen Times. Skipping over our speaker, Pam Constable of the Washington Post and chair of the National Press Club Freedom of the Press Committee. David D. Cook, another one of our winners here from the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Patriot News. Lee Feldman, National Planning, Capital Planning Commission and chair of the Freedom of the Press Awards Judging Panel. Brian Duffy, another colleague. Former colleague, editor at U.S. News and World Report magazine, Kati Marton, chair of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Kalayla Kalau, winner of the 1993 International Freedom of the Press Award, who came to us from Zaire over a year ago. He has spent the entire year in the United States learning a new talent. He would like to come up and demonstrate it to you.
Speak English. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President, today I must thank the National Press Club for all the help you have given me. Thanks.
Thank you. A year ago, Mr. Kalau could not speak a word of English. I'd also like to recognize four of the judges of the Freedom of the Press Awards: Andy Mosier of the Washington Post, Pierre Lesourde of Agency France-Presse, Robert Doherty of Reuters, and Daniel Franklin of The Economist. They all sitting at the table back there. Please stand, please. And finally, I would like to recognize the ambassador from Yemen, His Excellency Mohsin Al-Ani. Today, we are honoring four journalists for their outstanding contributions to press freedom. The first place winners in the domestic category are David D. Cook of the Patriot News of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and jointly John Walcott and Brian Duffy of U.S. News and World Report. In the international category, excuse me, the winner is Abdulaziz Al-Sakaf. All right, editor and publisher of the Yemen Times. David D. Cook, as a reporter for the Patriot News, documented the collapse of the corporate life insurance company, the largest insurance company failure in the history of Pennsylvania, And he did it despite a gag order by a local judge. Because of this order, insurance agents selling policies to customers who called to check on Corporate Life's condition were told by the state insurance department that all was well with the company. In fact, it was not. After the Patriot News went to court, DeCook was allowed access to the sealed documents for one day and one day only. What emerged from his investigation were the records and numerous interviews was a complex story of bad business, alleged fraud, and feeble regulation. State lawmakers are considering public hearings to look into the situation. David, would you come forward, please? Congratulations.
There's the award.
My congratulations.
Thank you.
You have your turn.
Thank you. This caps one of the more fascinating stories I ever worked on, and it goes to show that when the sports editor of your newspaper gives you a tip that doesn't involve horse racing, listen carefully. That's what got me on the Corporate Life story. Boiled down to its essence, this was a story about the importance of a free flow of facts. A 21-month gag order by Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court prevented the state insurance department from telling anyone what a bad company Corporate Life was. At the same time, it allowed the insurance department to conceal its own incompetent handling of the Corporate Life affair, and it allowed Corporate Life to continue to sell millions of dollars worth of annuities to thousands of unknowing victims while this fiasco was in progress, all the while telling the court it was a victim of a state vendetta. Facts have a history of being inconvenient, and I think one of the greatest services we do as journalists is to challenge conventional wisdom with facts, be it the truth about, say, the McDonald's coffee lady incident, or in our case, what lay behind the $250 million collapse of a small life insurance company. We risk too much if we allow myths and lies to masquerade as the truth. I'm continually surprised and touched at how grateful members of the public can be when you make an effort to tell the truth about something they really care about. Sometimes we don't realize what a negative opinion of the press that some people have. I was talking the other day to the chief clerk of Commonwealth Court, and he knew a lot about the Corporate Life case. He had heard about my award, and he told me how much he liked my stories. You know, he said, you could have taken a populist approach. You could have written it to make Commonwealth Court look bad. You could have made the insurance department look bad. And you could have made Corporate Life look bad. And at this point, I'm thinking, did I wimp out or what? But he continued, no, you stuck to the facts. And it dawned on me that he thought most of us would do otherwise, that we would distort the truth or publish rumor and speculation to make a better story. In truth, my series made them all look bad, but the facts wouldn't have it any other way. I want to thank the National Press Club for this distinguished award, the Patriot News of Harrisburg for the considerable amount of time and resources that made this story possible, and my wife Lisa for her personal support. Thank you all.
U.S. News and World Report editors John Walcott and Brian Duffy began an investigation of the CIA following the arrest, the much-publicized arrest, of Aldrich Ames. The U.S. News account focused on the CIA's Operations Directorate, the agency's elite clandestine service. What they found were fraudulent reports of agent recruitment, million-dollar payments to double agents, and the mishandling of defectors. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence voted to withhold funding of a portion of the CIA budget until better management and accountability procedures were put in place, all as a result of the U.S. News and World Report story. John and Brian, congratulations.
Thank you to the judges and all of you for coming here. I have to admit that I feel a little embarrassed sharing a podium with Dr. Al-Sakaf and with our other colleagues who have to practice our craft under much more difficult circumstances than any of us in the United States will ever experience. The job of trying to to bring to countries that have no tradition of freedom of the press, a free press, is far more difficult than reporting on the clandestine service in the CIA. Secondly, I think in awards of this type, the credit is often misplaced, and I think in this case, a lot of the credit goes to the people who spoke to us, to the officers of the clandestine service, especially those who were still serving undercover, who had the courage to speak out about what they saw as the wrongdoing in their own institution. That takes far more courage than either Brian or I ever exhibited in the reporting of this story. And I'd like to thank all of them by name, but I think I won't. So instead, again, I'll just thank you all very much.
And finally, Dr. Al Sakaf, publisher and editor-in-chief of Yemen's most independent newspaper, the Yemen Times. He has courageously reported on government corruption, mismanagement, and human rights abuses, despite enduring abuses of his own. During the civil war between North and South Yemen, the paper's account of the battle that started the war contradicted the official government line by maintaining that it was the northern troops, not the southern, that opened fire first. He also published casualty figures time and again that were higher than official government estimates. He and six other journalists were arrested and beaten. He has survived. It took him 3 days, but he's here with us today, Dr. Kassaf. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm overwhelmed. I'd like to tell you that I come from a very small village from Yemen. I was the firstborn son in my father's family, and I was destined to be a bricklayer like my father. In our tradition, the firstborn son has to follow in the father's profession. As I grew up, something beautiful happened to me. The American government gave me a Fulbright scholarship. It broke that cycle. And I was finally a graduate from Harvard University. It is a big change in my life. Today, this recognition will add another twist, positive twist, another change to my life. And I hope to the life of all my colleagues in my country as well as the region. I'm extremely grateful. I believe that my country will prosper only if it becomes a good world citizen. And that's what I try to do in as little as I can. And I'm happy to note that my country is moving along this direction. For the last 4 years, we have been doing a lot to democratize the country, to move towards pluralism, liberal politics, and market economics. We have our ups and downs. I have myself suffered from the downs. But I'd like also to use this moment to give credit to my own country for the many ups in our recent history. Thank you all for everything.
Our guest speaker today follows two simple rules. Write only what you see and never do anything dangerous just for fun. These guidelines have given him a margin of credibility and safety on some of the bloodiest battlefields of the last three decades. born in New England and born in New Zealand. Arnett moved from small newspapers to the Associated Press. In 1966, he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the war in Vietnam, where he stayed until the fall of Saigon. As we all know, truth is frequently a casualty of war. From Vietnam to Grenada, from Panama to the Persian Gulf, every effort was made to keep the American press away from the battlefield and from the sources of information. Arnett's probing coverage got him into trouble with American generals in Vietnam, KGB strongmen in Moscow, and presidents and presidential spokesmen in Washington. Most of us know Peter from his reporting from Baghdad on the Persian Gulf War for CNN. His was the last interview of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein with a Western reporter. He's no stranger to the Press Club, which honored him with its fourth estate award in 1991. After 35 years of reporting and 17 wars, I can think of no one more qualified to talk about freedom of the press than our guest speaker. We are privileged to have with us today Peter Arnett.
Thanks. Thank you, Bud. And my congratulations to all of you prize winners, all clearly richly deserved. I had the privilege of addressing you folks for the first time 4 years ago, almost to this date. It was March 16, 1991, the day I returned from the Gulf War. I had bodyguards at that gathering. There were threatening phone calls. Conservative pickets were outside the press building protesting with their signs, Baghdad Pete. And CNN was getting mail such as this little letter, and it says, "To Arnett, Holloman, and Shaw, the three stooges of Iraq." Or this one to me in the form of a verse which I dug out of my files the other day. It reads, "There's a wonderful name, just give it a try. It sure sounds terrific when telling a lie. Benedict Arnett is simple and sweet. It fits most reporters, but you've got them beat." It is not signed Newt Gingrich. I can't decipher the signature, but it's not Newt. So they were controversial days. Those Gulf War days, there's been a lot of controversy swirling around me, other reporters here in Washington, and in battlefields since the Vietnam War basically opened up reporting, when reporters began questioning American policy internationally. But I wish that the world's media in their own crises could face no more harmful threats than those angry pickets outside the press club 4 years ago that greeted me, or a few phone calls, or that doggerel voice that my Baghdad coverage inspired. In fact, as Bill Orme, executive director of the admirable Committee to Protect Journalists, detailed so graphically this morning in his organization's annual report, our colleagues in at least 23 countries are more likely to be thrown in jail for journalistically challenging their governments. In fact, more reporters are in jail than ever before, he reported, or they could be killed. The committee mentions the cases of 58 journalists murdered for their reporting in 1994, the largest number since the organization began keeping statistics a decade ago. So I ask you today, are we doing enough to assist our colleagues abroad? Awards are wonderful. Support such as today's gathering, it's wonderful. Are we doing enough by assisting them? Are we advancing really the cause of free press and therefore democracy in this post-Cold War world? We have a notable record of defending abuse and defamation against journalists here at home. In a real sense, I believe we also have a responsibility for the fate of our embattled colleagues abroad. One of the reasons is that we are the role model for many of these threatened journalists. Now, prize winner from Yemen, a Fulbright scholar, graduated from Harvard, surely imbued in Harvard with the American ideals of democracy, of press freedom. Many reporters that I meet abroad say they've been inspired by the American media and its traditions. The media is claimed to be the linchpin of our democracy. Ask Russian camera crews who covered the Chechen war in December and January, why did they cover that war so valiantly? And they'll cite the example of CNN's coverage of the attempted Moscow coup against Boris Yeltsin in 93 as the example they want to follow. I met so many young reporters from Asia, the Middle East, Europe, and Africa wanting my advice on becoming a war correspondent because they watch what CNN does. And how many young guys want to be Larry King and interview celebrities and have their own celebrity shows in Africa and Europe and elsewhere? And of course, America's major newspapers, for those who have access to them, for reporters, broadcasters, and others who visit the United States, they're examples that newly emerging democracies, publishers would desire to emulate. So our system is the role model for a developing world of newspapers, magazines, and broadcasters. It's an embattled world, but it's also a fascinating one, and I know it's an inspiring one for all of us who believe that free press and free thought are integral to free people. I've been calling around some of the executives, officials, colleagues who are more active in the pursuit of basic freedoms, who are interested in what's going on in the world, who are reporting to us about what's going on. And from then I've learned that it's not all bad news. One of the reasons that there is more repression against the media today is that there is more media to repress. Not so long ago, in many of these now violent environments, there was no free press whatsoever. So we are involved, I've learned, probably to a greater degree than you realize in really aiding and helping our international colleagues to establish themselves. So let me quickly run through at this point sort of what's happening out there and what we're doing about it. We have the Committee to Protect Journalists, which reported this morning. We know what they're doing, their activities, monitoring international events, bringing in students, officials, others, putting out pamphlets to our own correspondents who go to cover wars, how to conduct themselves, helping our people along with journalists in the countries they're covering. We have the Freedom Forum that is extremely active internationally and becoming even more so. 11 libraries abroad now established, computer-equipped suburb databases for all journalists from Hong Kong to Eastern Europe to get information. I mean, if journalism is factual information, you can get it from the computers in the Freedom Forum. You have many other fellowship programs. I mentioned the Knight Fellowship, sending journalists overseas in sabbaticals to teach journalists in Africa and elsewhere, sort of a Press Corps Peace Corps, been active for several years. And others that I don't have the time to name, but even the U.S. government has been doing up to this year an enormous amount, really. The International Media Fund in Eastern Europe, they trying to jumpstart the press in some former communist countries, even bought a printing press for new newspapers in Albania, helped TV broadcasting, but the government is getting out of that short-term program. Government's getting out a lot of programs. The problems, fragile economy, of course, in Africa, Eastern Europe, Ukraine. These journalists, these newspapers, broadcasters, have been dependent on government funding, of course, as they try to make their own way. They've got to get their own sources of money. Latvia is strapped for resources. Can't even get paper and ink, really. Very difficult. They need training for journalists. Paper shortages are a problem elsewhere in the world, and generally, the funding. Now, foundations, international foundations, have been a valuable source of resources, certainly in Eastern Europe, but my colleague Ed Fui, a former broadcaster who is interested in developing media abroad, tells me that One of these organizations, the Transatlantic Dialogue on Broadcasting, run by a colleague of his from the BBC, could get no funding this year from the European Union for its activities. You know, and its main mission is to help build an independent news departments and state-run or independent new televisions in Eastern Europe. Couldn't get any funding from the European Union. And he is concerned that maybe foundations are losing interest, which is a pity. And the point being, of course, that foundations should know, as we know, that how can you build a democracy anywhere if you do not have free press institutions? Now, I'm more familiar with CNN operations, and particularly the CNN World Report, where we run unedited video packages put together from television organizations around the world. They just send them to us, and we put them on the air, no money exchange. Now, I must admit that when World Report, which was most innovative, first went on the air in 1987, there was a high cringe factor. If you were watching it, the video was pretty bad, the audio was even worse, and the content of those packages, thank goodness we didn't have many viewers in those days, heavy on features and a lot of rubbishy stuff. But let me give credit, if any needs to be given anymore, to Ted Turner's vision. I have been informed I'm entitled to one commercial during this speech, so I'll do it for Ted. Ted's vision, his foresight, because not only did CNN use the TV products from around the world, we invited the broadcasters initially to annual conferences in Atlanta, launched an international professional program that is 6 weeks in duration. We helped new broadcasters develop writing, editing skills, managing management practices, buying advertising, salesmanship. We provide the whole Turner Broadcasting staff is at their disposal. We've helped just recently personnel from 5 new TV stations that have just opened in Russia and new broadcasters in the Ukraine, Belarus, Estonia, Belgrade, where the famous Studio B operates, the voice of the opposition in Serbia. And today there is no cringe factor when you watch the World Report. The quality is often up to CNN news standards. In fact, we air it every day, nearly 6 hours of original broadcasting every week, and that comes from 150 broadcasters from 115 countries around the world. And our membership is increasing at the rate of 20% annually. So you can see the input that we are getting from countries around the world, and in exchange, they are getting from us expertise and advice and other support in their own operations. Of course, the other factor that ensures CNN's acceptance around the world was our coverage from both sides of the Gulf War, and we've come to see that that gave an international credibility to the American news media that had never before had existed. We, not just in CNN, but the American media became more trusted. So now you can have Nightline showing in Europe and Asia. Now Katie Couric on the Today Show is visible. The concerns in Europe and elsewhere that American had imperialistic journalism are less evident now. And part of it was the Gulf War coverage that CNN takes pride in having done, but also other American media, all the other American media did a fine job in covering that Gulf War. So we run these broadcasters through our training programs. They come to visit, and interesting what they ask us, these broadcasters and radio people. How much government control is there at CNN, they want to know. Do we kill stories the government disapproves of? Are we beholden more than we admit to promoting government policies? And they want to know basic things like what geopolitical factors make an international news story. That sort of stumped me, you know. Why is Rwanda important finally? Well, it was after a while. Or why is Bosnia less important? But that sort of discussion I have. What domestic news of their own is of interest to the outside world? Many of these broadcasters and news people tell us, frankly, they can't be objective back home, particularly Africa and the Middle East. If they were, it would be their hides. But we find that many of these people dissident intellectuals, they take pride in being fair and accurate, and they're brave, and some have made it to the CPJ's casualty lists. Of course, some of the broadcasters take a few shortcuts. A gentleman from a news station in Uganda told us a couple of weeks ago of a foolproof way he had of getting advertising. He said he would simply do stories on the companies that purchased his ads. We told him that was not quite the way to create a free press. And personnel from Channel A in Slovenia, it's a new private broadcasting outlet, impressed World Report executives with their daring style, and they had a funky use of graphics, and they build themselves as the underdogs in the business in Slovenia. But we find that they're gaining fast on the opposition, and the way they do that, that each evening Channel A's news reports are being sandwiched between three pornographic movies. Hey. Of course, our enthusiastic colleagues abroad often collide with retrogressive politicians with their own cultures. The developing media, of course, wants changes to be made in the scene. But as we have seen, as their influence increases in their home regions, as their demands grow for more freedom, so does direct action against them intrude upon their hopes. Murder, imprisonment have become the bloody birth pangs of a freer world. And more you hear about press laws, demands for media responsibility in these countries. What are these but code phrases for controls of the media? So what can we do to further the cause of the adolescent media in Eastern Europe, Central Asia, aid the growth of the independent press in Africa, the Middle East, and elsewhere? First of all, we can do more and we must do more. I've hailed the fine efforts already being made by our own professional organizations and media companies. Direct action through the Committee to Protect Journalists and the Overseas Press Club and the Freedom Forum and other concerned media groups can have immediate results. When the CPJ was advised last year of the arrest of a reporter and editor-in-chief of a leading newspaper in the Albanian capital, arrested for reporting the, quote, state secret, unquote, that the government would take guns away from off-duty army officers, a protest was quickly faxed from the CPJ to the government. The trials went ahead anyway, and there were convictions. But a second detailed protest worked just one day after it was publicized internationally, and the news people were released, and there was a bonus, a marked decline in the legal harassment of Albania's increasingly independent news media. The Freedom Forum facilities in Hong Kong recently became a forum for a protest against the Indonesian government's closure of three Jakarta newspapers. The forum flew the three editors of the Indonesian papers to Hong Kong for a widely attended press conference to publicize the assault on media freedom. We can appeal to our government to place media issues on the political agenda when dealing with repressive companies, as did happen in Tajikistan. The CPJ's own Bill Orme and a personal visit to that Central Asian country last year highlighted the bloody struggle of journalists. 25 reporters and editors had been killed in Tajikistan in the previous 30 months. Now press freedom is on the agenda when our government meets with theirs. And let's remind our diplomats that worthy countries such as Poland have been promising for years to allow an independent TV media. Last year, the government passed legislation that was supposed to finally permit independent broadcasting, but they still haven't issued any licenses. And Romania and other countries are proving most unwilling to give up control of broadcasting. So they should be nudged towards that fact. But let's face it, press freedom is not a high priority for any government, sometimes even our own, I feel. So in the final analysis, we can do more of what we do best ourselves, publicize abuses of our media colleagues. For example, for our international correspondents, allow them to report on the reporters just as they do on developing political systems and free markets. I sometimes detect a reluctance to defend our own press interests abroad, that it's easier to speak out on behalf sometimes of imprisoned doctors or political students than journalists. But press freedom should be a routine item on our checklist when we visit these countries. I don't believe it's special pleading to highlight the struggles of the emerging media abroad. We know from our own history that a free press is an integral part of a free society, societies that we as a people and human beings applaud. We are rightly spotlighting the travails of the media in our coverage of Russia, where the press story is major news. But are we giving attention to the rest of the developing world? Vietnam, for example, where many of us are heading in the next few weeks to cover the 20th anniversary of the war's end. Does the Vietnamese government give as much attention to press freedom as it does to American investment in that country? Let's hope we read about it and see it on our TV programming. Publicity, publicity, information, that's what we are all about. It's our most powerful weapon. Let's use it more to help our embattled colleagues. Just one example, the Argentine government recently drafted legislation that promised draconian libel laws directed at the media, sort of high-fine, low-proof laws. The New York Times editorially criticized the upcoming legislation, and it's been dropped, apparently for good. Publicity, publicity. You have to know what's going on, of course, in the world to be involved, and let me recommend the best journalist tip sheet in the business. It's the International Free Exchange Network, known by the acronym IFEX. It's created by the Canadian Committee to Protect Journalists, headquartered in Toronto, and IFEX keeps you daily up to date on the state of the media internationally with names and addresses, victims and violators. It's a scorecard on the state of freedom in the world today. Every news organization, every reporter should be hooked into the IFEX system. After all, facts are our business, the truth is our business. Moving into the existing technology is a necessity, and all of the Freedom Forum's publications, for example, are now on the internet, as are many others. So that's something about the struggle to establish an American-style media in the world's emerging democracies, and some of the reasons why I feel we should do more to assist our embattled colleagues, and it's certainly worth thinking about on this Freedom of Information Day. Thank you.
Now we'll have questions, and they're for a variety of a number of our speakers. First for you, Mr. Arnett. Can you give us an update on Iraq? Should the embargo on the sale of Iraqi oil be eased?
Certainly the Iraqis believe the sanctions should be lifted. I was there last October, and CNN, along with many other journalists, were invited, and they did make the eloquent argument that the population was suffering grievously, were being harmed by the continued implementation of the sanctions. While we were there, the Russian foreign minister arrived to support Iraq's claim, and it's clear since then that France and other countries are getting behind the Iraqi plea that the sanctions be lifted. The U.S. government, of course, has prevailed in its view that it is too early, that more pressure should be put on Saddam Hussein. We read, and only by this pressure will he totally implement the U.N. requirements for the sanctions to be lifted, or the other side of the coin being that he'll be overthrown. And I keep reading these days about attempted coup d'etats, possible coup d'etats against him. So if you're sympathetic to the Iraqis, clearly the sanctions should be lifted. If you're sympathetic to the U.S. government point of view, they shouldn't be. Thank you.
You spoke about the World Report, and yet a questioner notes that CNN has bumped it in favor of extensive coverage of the O.J. Simpson trial. When can we expect World Report to be back on schedule?
CNN's bumping virtually everything in favor of the O.J. Simpson trial simply because there seems to be an insatiable public demand for information about that trial. Not only the detailed minute by minute court coverage of what's going on, but discussion about it, endless discussion. People phone us, they fax us, they send letters saying, keep it all coming. So, you know, as I used to say about the Vietnam War, one day it'll be over. And I think that one day the O.J. Simpson trial will be over. I would like to point out that CNN has another channel called CNN International, seen by those who travel beyond the United States and by increasing numbers of Americans at home, which does not cover the O.J. trial, you know, gavel to gavel, argument to argument, but does have World Report and much other foreign news on it. And we hope by midsummer that CNN domestically will be back to its old schedule. Thank you.
For Dr. Arthur Kopp, is freedom of the press in Yemen on the rise or decline since the end of the war?
Thank you. Since the war, the scope of freedom of the press in Yemen has diminished dramatically, of course. I would like to think, and this may be wishful thinking, that this is a temporary phase. But the facts are that the scope of freedom of the press in Yemen has fallen dramatically. Thank you.
I think this is for you, Peter. I'm not sure, but several years ago, the United Nations was pushing a new information order to emphasize good news in the third world and to change the flow of news from the developed to developing countries. What happened to that movement? Are you familiar with that? Or
yeah.
All right.
I can address that. It was a UNESCO attempt to create a new information order in the late 60s and the 70s. It was vehemently opposed by the U.S. mainstream media, and it died a natural death, as did at the time, really, American participation in UNESCO, which I believe is still, we're still not back in UNESCO. But I hear recurring attempts to sort of reestablish some kind of ideal that more positive reporting, you know, come out of the developing world, that it would be in the best interests of nations to get a positive viewpoint placed on them. I think if you talk to any reporters in the new media in these emerging countries, they want to get out there and do exactly what we're doing in the United States, tell the truth, you know, with their equivalent of glasnost and perestroika. Get information out there, shake up the government, shake up the authorities and the institutions, and let's get moving towards real democracy. Thank you.
Questioner asks, what problems are created when the U.S. press does a better job than the local press in a country in covering that country's problems? For example, in Mexico, the U.S., or so the questioner says, does a better job than Mexican journalists in covering assassinations, corruption, and the influence of drug money on politics in Mexico. What problems does that create for American journalists?
I don't think that's always true. I think there are superb Mexican journalists, superb Mexican newspapers, and I would question whether our reporting is superior. And even if it is, the Mexican people don't really get access to it. CNN is seen there, and other American news media, I guess, crosses the border. But I don't really think it is a factor what we do and what they do. What I've found personally, however, being with CNN in a place like Haiti, is that where the ruling establishment watches CNN on a 24-hour basis, then anything I did on the air was immediately noticed, and it was only within a few days after I arrived that people would pass by and throw things at me while I was going live from downtown, or threaten me for the coverage that they were seeing back at their own homes. And so I think as the U.S. media starts being projected back into these communities, we'll maybe having continuing problems such as in Somalia. Really, though, wherever U.S. media go and there's any kind of environment where there's a developing local media, they will come to us for advice. We will turn to them for assistance. And so If we are superior in our performance, hopefully we can lift up the local broadcasters and reporters along with us and really improve their product.
This has been a presentation of the National Press Club and the Internet Multicasting Service.